the 3rd of November, and Steve Haig and Jim Packel are interviewing Dr. Alan A. McRae. And Dr. McRae was just telling about, we were talking about an ordination preparation seminar going on at this hour in our chapel. And Dr. McRae was telling that he felt that at Princeton, people got just enough Hebrew to get by, and when they started Westminster, if 2 hours were added over and above what had been required at Princeton, it would give people enough to use their Hebrew more. And so he was just at the point of telling Dr. Machen's reaction.
Well, this was, of course, my second year. My first year, I was really learning to teach Hebrew. I had to throw away the methods that were previously used. And I worked out a method by which they learned much more Hebrew than they ever had before. But in addition to that, as a new teacher, I had very little idea of how much you had a right to require. And so I required my students to study 4 hours for every hour of class. And I used to tell them, I don't care how stupid you are, if you'll put in 4 hours in learning what I present to you, you will pass this course 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. But I said, I don't care how bright you are, if you put in less than 4 hours, you're not going to get this material well enough that you'll pass this course. Well, that was the first year. The second year, I was more established, of course, by that time, and a little surer of myself. And so, after school had been going a brief time, well, I proposed that we add 2 hours to the requirement for Hebrew, because I thought with 2 hours more, they would get to the point where they would really use it. And Dr. Machen and Dr. Machen said, I don't know, he says, about adding two more Hebrew. He says, I don't know where they'd learn any Greek if you did that, which I thought was sort of a compliment to the interest that the students had in the Hebrew as I gave it. But Dr. Wilson, then, who was a grand fellow, but he said, these Greeks, he says, they're always interfering with our getting the Hebrew right. And, of course, then the chance was lost. But when we started Faith, we simply added the 2 hours. And our students learned Hebrew, learned it well. But Mr. Packel was saying at our last meeting how the men of the RP was what had meant so much to him. The fine spirit and attitude those fellows had. And they were practically all graduates of FASA. And it was what we tried to build there that developed men like that. And we have a large group of them today in the country who were trained during those 16 years, 15 years that we were at Wilmington.
I think of people like Bill Leonard,
for
example, who
had
a tremendous ministry in Colorado Springs as a pastor, and many years of fruitful ministry as a chaplain as well. Bill Leonard. William B. Leonard Jr., now executive director of our chaplains commission, represents the best, I think, of that those years at Faith and that whole Bible Presbyterian and RP tradition. Many others like him.
And I think the Lord prepared the way for the training of these people. And I was thinking of the different elements that entered into it. One of them, of course, was Dr. Buswell's interest. Dr. Buswell had gotten interested in Westminster and had tried to support it as well as he could. And then when they turned the students bitterly against him and everything he stood for, it was a great disappointment to him. And he realized how things had gone, and we had talked with him about it, and we thought of possibly starting a seminary at Wheaton College to carry on. I'm glad we didn't. I think as an independent organization, we had more freedom to develop things the way that we felt the Lord would want us to. But And he sent us a great many students, and he gave me the opportunity every year to go and speak for twice in chapel, successive days. And then I'd stay two or three days after that and interview students. And this, many of these students had that background of that fine Christian testimony that Dr. Buswell had made so vital a thing in the lives of the students there at Wheaton. That was one thing that entered into it. Another thing that entered into it was that we were in the at Wilmington there. We had our meetings in the Sunday school rooms of Dr. Laird's church. And Dr. Laird did some part-time teaching in the seminary. And Dr. Laird had a tremendous influence on the students. He was a marvelous man, wonderful Christian. And his preaching was just an example of what preaching ought to be. His delivery and his content and everything about it. And the students, of course, were all there through the week. Many of them would go to his midweek meeting. And the great bulk of them would attend the meeting on Sunday at his church. And that was a big thing that entered into it. Another thing I thought that entered into it was that we were free from traditions as to how a seminary ought to be. I had heard a lot while I was at Princeton, being quite intimate with Dr. Robert Dick Wilson and Dr. John Gresham Machen, about their difficulties and their problems and so on. And I had seen what they were trying to do to take care of them. And then at Westminster, the faculty was so disgusted at the way the president of Princeton had acted in helping to tear down the testimony of the school, that they didn't want a president. So Dr. Wilson was chairman of the faculty the first year, and Dr. Machen after that, and most everything was fully discussed in the faculty meetings. And that gave a marvelous view of what the seminary problems ought to be and the different ways they could be handled and so on. So I had had that experience in taking it over. And we put our stress on what does the Bible teach? What is the biblical answer? At Princeton, they were devoted to the truth of the Bible as the foundation, there was not a centrality of viewpoint and purpose like this. The purpose was to get a great many of them were professional men who wanted to get a chance to have a church, be a pastor, and they were getting what is necessary for this professional training rather than learning how to serve the Lord effectively. And these courses had to be taken. Well, we were interested in the accomplishment and what we were trying to do to represent the Lord, to make Him known, to help people to grow in grace and the knowledge of the Lord. And then we never could have started the seminary without Dr. McIntyre's input. Dr. McIntyre had been in my first Hebrew class I taught the first year I was at Westminster. And after 2 years, my first 2 years there, he graduated and took a little church down in Ventnor. And he was there for, 5 or 6 years. I used to often go down there and preach for him. And then when he left that church, because he was called to the Collingswood Church to succeed Dr. Laird there, they said the folks were just weeping at the farewell service down in Ventnor. And he had such an influence on them, and they were so devoted to his preaching. Well, he was by this time fairly well established, and it was the financial support that he brought was from that aspect, the big thing that made it possible to carry on the seminary. Well, of course, we didn't know where we would start the seminary. We discussed various possibilities, and he suggested they had in their church, they had the most excellent facilities, that if we could have the meetings right there. But it would not have been wise to, because he, having left the Presbyterian Church in the USA, out of his church of 600, the people who had built the church, When it started less than 10 years before, they'd all gone with him, walked out and met in a tent. And six people hadn't gone. So those six people sued for the property, and the courts gave it to them. So they had the church, and he had to meet in a tent. Well, this was just a year or two before that happened. And with this all up in the air like that, he couldn't very well start a seminary in the church building. So we had to look elsewhere. And we looked at various things. And then the idea came of taking using the Sunday school rooms of Dr. Laird's church. And of course that was wonderful because it tied us with Dr. Laird's marvelous Christian teaching. But Dr. McIntyre was able to raise the greater part of the money that was needed. Now, of course, he wasn't in a position to raise all that was needed yet, and so the faculty often went 3 or 4 months behind in their salaries, like we did here when the first couple of years here. But without what he raised, we could not, it'd be difficult to see how we could have gotten along. He was a tremendous help to us in those days. Dr. McIntyre, in his early days, they say the sermons he preached, the way he opened the Word of God, was just tremendous. And people were tremendously blessed by it. And the church was growing there, and he was having a wonderful spiritual influence on people's lives. And he had been enough devoted to the professors he'd studied under at Westminster that I don't think he ever would have stopped supporting them if they treated him decently. But they treated him the last couple of years there as an enemy. And whether it was because he was a premillennialist, whether it was he thought the students shouldn't be encouraged to smoke, what the reasons were, he was never there obnoxious about any of these things. But he did appear before the faculty and object to the fact that premillennialism was so treated in the teaching of most of the classes, and the board was three-fourths premillennial, I'm quite sure. But that was the attitude of the faculty, and he was very gracious then in his meeting and his attitude to the faculty, of whom I was simply one when he appeared before us.
Now, whose idea was it to start a new seminary again? How did that come about again?
Well, Dr. Buswell had been looking at Westminster as the great solution to our problems, and Westminster was failing us. And Dr. Buswell was quite influential in it. We thought of starting at Wheaton. Mm-hmm. And in fact, here's a funny thing that happened. H. McAllister Griffiths was the defender in the church courts of Dr. Machen and appeared in the General Assembly on their behalf. It was very vital in all this. And there was a lawyer who had a Christian lawyer who was not directly connected with us, but who had taken an interest in the matter and had given some very fine suggestions. They're very helpful. And one day, he met Dr. Griffiths, and he says, "Dr. Griffiths," he says, how's your seminary getting on?" Well, Dr. Griffiths says, "Things have gone bad on there." She says, "We're thinking of starting a seminary in connection with Wheaton College." And, is that so? He said. Well, 2 years later, he suddenly died. And when he died, it was found in his will that it was stated that he was leaving $400,000 to Wheaton College, provided that the college either had a theological seminary training course or started one within 6 months of his death. Well, he was right in the prime of life. Nobody expected him to die then. But the result was that Wheaton, we didn't get the money, and it was us he was interested in, that is, Griffiths was one of our strong supporters. And Dr. Buswell was one of our strong supporters. And when the Wheaton board refused to start it there, Dr. Buswell was very much disappointed, told us he'd do anything he could to help us to start one somewhere else. But now Wheaton got this $400,000 on condition within 6 months after his death, or of course while he was living, that they have a theological seminary training course. Well, it didn't specifically say it had to be a separate institution or anything like that. Just exactly what those words meant might be questioned. But the Wheaton board had an opportunity to get that money, and so of course they started a graduate work in theology, and that's how Wheaton comes to have that.
Their graduates go, yeah.
Yes. That's how it's
going. Who is that gentleman that donated that?
I forget his name, but I think they used his name in connection with it there. Seems to me that they put it on, or the name of his wife, if it was her honor or something. But anyway, that didn't help us a bit. But Dr. McIntyre had already been publishing the Beacon for 2 or 3 years. And it was getting an influence. It's interesting, at that time, a man told me that he had a friend who had never been interested in church at all, who lived down in Atlantic City or somewhere down that area, and he said he's just so enamored of those sermons Dr. McIntyre gives Sunday mornings on the radio that he just can't bear to miss one of them. And he was getting an influence with the radio, with the Beacon, and the people in the Collingswood Church were just devoted to him. And that wasn't enough to pay all the expenses of the seminary, but it was enough to make the big difference between getting along and not being able to go at all. So that was another thing the Lord used to enable us to get going. And of course, with Dr. Buswell's help and the help of the three, we had three men who would have been seniors in Westminster the next year, who signed up during the summer. And I had a dream, and I dreamt that October 1st came, the seminary started, and we only had three students. But the rest of them came in along in September, but there was a large group that Dr. Buswell influenced in our direction, including Jack Murray and quite a large number of others. And of course, we had Francis Schaefer, who was a tremendous help to us as a senior, and Douglas Young, too, had a great influence. And Dr. McIntyre said to me, he says, we don't want to have a president of this seminary, we'll have a chairman of the faculty, just like Princeton Westminster had. And he said, but he was going, of course, to be president of the board of trustees. So I said, well, I guess you'll be the president of the seminary. I wouldn't make much of a seminary president, or some remark like that. But after we got to going, why, we'd get letters addressed to the president, Faith Seminary, and I would ship them on to Collingswood, and he would ship them back to me. And then he said, you take letters, come addressed to the president. He says, you take care of them. He says, you don't need to send them over to me. Well, then we had a man spoke in the seminary, and he gave a wonderful message, I remember. But as he was leaving, going out, he said to me, he says, who's the president of school? Well, I'm chairman of the faculty. Well, I might as well have said I'm carpenter. I could see it meant nothing to me. But the next summer, now we had to establish this thing. So Dr. Buswell even told students I would be at Wheaton the next year. And he, I think it cut down our entering students a bit. He told them I would be there the next year. And he tried to get me to go to Wheaton the next year. Well, having started the seminary, I wasn't going to leave it right then. So I did not. But Dr. McIntyre heard that I might go to Wheaton. He and I had had a slight disagreement right then. So when he asked me about it, I gave him a non-committal answer and said I hadn't made up my mind yet or something like that. And in the end, he said he was just about ready to do most anything to keep me there. So while I said it's kind of a nuisance, people are used to having the term president used, and you notice this mail we get and everything, it's kind of, oh, I'd be glad to have you play with president, he said. So he moved in the board of directors, I'd be given the title of president. And Dr. McPherson says, no, what does that mean? Is he president of the seminary, president of the faculty? Well, Dr. McIntyre kind of pushed the question aside and we went on. So there was no decision made on that. But whenever he would write me, he'd always call me president of faculty. But when he told in the Beacon about the start of the American Council, he told how one of the original founders of the American Council of Christian Churches was the president of the seminary, Dr. McCrae. But his support was, without it, we couldn't have started.
How did the formation of the denomination dovetail with the formation of Faith Seminary?
Well, Faith was, when we started, the question of the Collingswood Church was before the courts. Well, about three quarters of the year had gone when the courts gave the property to the six people who had stayed with it instead of to the 1,500 or so who had walked out and were worshiping in a tent. And that stirred our students up tremendous. And that helped to arouse great interest in the idea of starting a new church. And I think it was during the previous summer that the independent board had its big split, which I guess I haven't told about in these letters. We'll tell about that sometime. But we had to start a new church with our leaders being expelled from the old church. And they had the OPC, which they called the Presbyterian Church of America, but the recent graduates had complete control of that. So we had to start a new church. So we started the Bible Presbyterian Church. Dr. Buzzwell suggested the name, Bible Presbyterian Synod, which he thought would be a fine name. And I went to... I went to... Wheaton has spoken chapel, and Dr. Gordon Clark said, he says, I don't like that name you've got there for your new church. I said, you don't? The Bible Presbyterian Church. Don't you like the word Presbyterian? Oh, yes, Presbyterian's wonderful. Well, I said, don't you like the word synod? Oh, no, synod, that's great. He says, I don't like that word Bible. It suggests loud singing, which I thought was rather amusing. But Dr. Buzzwell had talked about how synod is the meeting of the roads as the origin of the word. And it was a good name and so. But then when we had our first meeting of the Bible Presbyterian Synod, Dr. McIntyre ran a heading in the Beacon, Bible Presbyterian Synod becomes a church, or something like that. I forget about it. After that, it was always Bible Presbyterian Church.
So the denomination kind of developed developed very shortly then after the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Did
you sense that you were developing more out of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church? Or that it was so young that you were just kind of starting another new church out of the old Presbyterian Church USA?
It was out of the old Presbyterian Church USA, but it was reacting against the way that the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was going. because the recent graduates of Westminster were introducing, they must have wine that that is fermented, they must have. And they didn't, several of them didn't think it was right to sing anything but psalms. And of course, psalms are fine if you have them in modern English instead of antiquated phraseology, and if they fit the tunes, and some of their tunes were terrible. And they were so insistent on every little nicety of their views on theology that people would discuss it with the Presbyterian Church in the USA and would come to one of these meetings, they'd soon get disgusted and go back again. And those folks would mostly have gone back if we had given them a place to come to where they could have what the Presbyterian Church had been at its foundation. What these people wanted.
Did the Orthodox Presbyterians feel as though you were leaving them? Or how did they react to this new denomination?
Oh, they would have kicked us out if we hadn't left Rome. You can be sure of that.
But it wasn't really the founding of Faith Seminary that started the new denomination.
It was what provided ministers for it. But no, I wouldn't say it was what started. It provided ministers. We gave a background for bringing people together and
But the denomination was already in existence. I should remember history better than I do.
No,
the seminary was founded first, before the first synod.
Oh yeah, it was before our first synod, definitely. And at our first synod meeting, Dr. McIntyre was so afraid that people would think there was some kind of a machine or something that he didn't make the least effort to have any influence on who would be elected moderator. And we met, and they said, it's open for election moderator. Nobody said anything. And then somebody nominated a retired missionary who was a very nice fellow, but was not an outstanding character at all. And as Dr. McIntyre said to me later, he says, that man should have never been elected our first moderator. He said it should have been Dr. Laird, of course, he said. But nobody planned anything. And somebody got up and nominated this man, who was a nice fellow, but not an outstanding man at all. And I don't remember exactly when we held our first synod, but I know it was, I'm quite sure the seminary was going quite a while before we started the synod.
Dr. McCurry, before we close this session, one question. Why exactly did Boswell try and tell the students that you were coming there at that time?
Because he thought I would. You see, originally we planned to start at Wheaton.
Okay.
We planned to start a seminary there. And then the Wheaton board turned it down. And when the Wheaton board turned it down, Dr. Buzzell was just heartbroken. And he said, if you want to start a seminary somewhere else, he says, I'm not sure with my loyalty I have to show toward our board of directors that I could be a member of your board. But he said, I'll certainly do everything I possibly can to help you. And
he had the $400,000, I guess. Now.
Yeah, well, that's what made them start, you see. See, the board turned him down, and then when they got the $400,000, they proceeded. But, of course, as they said, I think the board was afraid of bringing this Presbyterian controversy onto their grounds. As they said to Dr. McIntyre once when he was at dinner out there, sat next to one of the board members, he said if we'd started that seminary here, it would have put that whole Presbyterian controversy right in the middle of the Wheaton campus. But of course, Wheaton was an interdenominational school, but Dr. Buzzwell was tried by the General Assembly, or by the Presbyterian Chicago, I guess it was, for being in the independent board. And they claimed to, to take off your gown, to unfrock anybody who stayed in the independent board. Yeah. some of these things I haven't thought of for 40 years, some of them for 50 years, and the chronology gets a bit confused in your mind, but one thing I should have mentioned that played a part in all this was the independent board. See, the independent board, as I told you, those two fellows said it was a very bad board because they had so many premillennialists on it. Well, the independent board had missionaries already. It was only a couple years old, but they had a missionary in Peru, and they had a lady in Arabia and a lady in India, and the lady in India had arranged for four new missionaries to come who were just graduating from Westminster. And these four were all set to go to India. And it happened that one of these four was a fellow, well, he was, what is it? Oh, I can't think of his name. He was a bright fellow and a very personable chap. And he was related to somebody who'd been interested in Westminster, and they thought it was a wonderful victory to get him to come to Westminster. Well, he just graduated from Westminster. But he had been with different, I mean, his contacts weren't all within the church. And when we came to the independent board meeting, which these fellows had been saying was privately was a terrible board, Dr. Laird was president of it. And that was during the summer before we started. Why, this Dr. Stamm, I think it was, said that he had heard that this fellow drank wine. And he wondered if we were sending to India a missionary who didn't hold our standards of the separated life, who used wine. And they asked him, and he got up and he made a very nice statement. He said that he had occasionally drunk wine and he hadn't seen anything wrong with it, but he says, out of deference to Dr. Stamm, to this board, he says, I'm ready to promise that I will not touch alcoholic beverages again. Well, then Dr. Stamm says, I'd like to know about these other missionaries, prospective missionaries. What do they think about this? Well, the other three were from strong prohibitionist backgrounds, all three of them, and backgrounds with much more in contact with their whole movement than this one fellow had. But they had been so brainwashed there that when they got up at that meeting and they asked if they would promise not to use fermented liquors for beverage purposes, or first asked them not to use fermented liquor, one of them said, well, he says if the doctor orders it for some sickness, I certainly will use it. Well, they changed it. So if they use it for beverage, it's a beverage. No, he wouldn't promise. So all three of these fellows refused to promise. So then somebody moved, we don't send them. And so they passed that they wouldn't send them. And none of them went to the mission field. And all four had been scheduled for it. And this one, he stayed in the Presbyterian Church USA, and I think that did fine work for the years, probably. The other three, they went with the OPC, the other three. But at the end of the meeting, the Westminster folks who were on the board all submitted their resignation. And you see, the Charlie Woodbridge had been general secretary of the board. And in the spring, when these things were developing, Woodbridge neglected the work of the board for the last couple of months there be to go around and propagandize for the faculty. And he did that and just neglected it. And then at the beginning of the summer, he said he resigned from the board. And, of course, that left the board with, I guess it was after this meeting, he resigned from the board. So then we had a meeting of the executive committee, and Dr. McIntyre asked me to step into the office for 2 months and run it. Well, I went in, and it wasn't 2 months, it was 4 months I was there through the summer. And the first thing was to try to get word to the missionaries as to what had happened. And I wrote a statement to get in, you know, that would give a real idea of what happened. And
this was after Dr. Machen had died in January, but before Faith started the following fall?
Yes. This meeting of the independent board where they broke from it, where they left it, that was in the summer, early summer. Yeah, I'm quite sure.
And that was what, 37?
37, yeah.
So Machen died in January, and this happened with the board in, which was his board, really.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, it was his board.
In that summer. And then Faith opened its doors that fall.
Yeah. And Dr. Machen had left a sum of money to Westminster Seminary on condition that its board of directors certify that they hold the same views that they did when it was started. So on. While he left an equal sum to the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, a Pennsylvania corporation. That's all his will said. And his brother, who that group got to and got pretty strongly on their side, he brought suit to keep the Independent Board from having that money. And Mr. Bennett appeared before the board for the trial. He said that evidence is to be taken from the four corners of the will as to what it meant. See, and that all this they were bringing in was quite irrelevant.
So the board did get that money.
The board got the money. It wasn't a big sum, but it was a help. But then there was a woman in Pittsburgh who had given the board, I think, $50,000. And the OPC folks got a hold of her. And she wrote and wanted that money back because the board was no longer standing for what it was working for. And it was brought up in the board, and someone there said, Mr. Arms, our treasurer, he said, I think the woman is completely misinformed, he says, but he says, I think the Christian thing for us to do is to give it back to her when she's asked for it. And so they did. And then later, she became a friend of theirs. But the feeling of they developed, it was more reminiscent of the situation in the war than anything I ever saw, the way the hatred they had for the people that weren't 100% ready, you know, to support their right down the line. It never would have developed. It would be just the same size, the OPC today, if we hadn't left it as it is. Because that's you'll never build a church with that kind of thing. But the Lord...
So you had just resigned at Westminster. You were making the plans to start the seminary that September. And you have these 2 months in between where you were also acting chairman of the board, or secretary.
4 months during the summer. They asked me to come in for 2 months.
You succeeded Woodbridge.
Yeah.
But he didn't resign because he sided with the Westminster folks.
That's why he resigned.
Oh, he did?
That was the whole thing. He sided with them 100%. He told the... he went around. He didn't do anything to advance the board during the last 2 months there. But he went around, this before he resigned even, he went around seeing the young ministers in the new church to try to persuade them to stand with Westminster against us. And neglected it. So when I got in, there were letters from the missionaries for 2 months back that he'd written that we're very busy right now. I'll answer all your questions next month. So he had put that off. He had... So that the board was in disarray, as you can imagine. And I went in there, no experience with anything like that, and all these problems, things to take a hold of. But I thought the first thing needed was to get word to the missionaries as to what the situation was. So I spent the first week writing a careful statement of what had happened to send to put in our independent board bulletin that would go to all our supporters and to the missionaries, a statement that would give the truth but in a non-inflammatory way, something that would show what the situation really was. And the secretary, a young woman who was very loyal to the board, but she knew there were letters came in that needed answering. I was working on this thing. When we had prayer, she prayed the Lord would help poor Dr. McCrae. He does not know where to begin. But they asked me to go in on half-time for 2 months, and I put in my full-time for 4 months. And of course, Francis Schaefer was a tremendous help to me. He would come in after the afternoon. We'd talk everything over fully. You know, he had good ideas. But even then, you could see the beginning of animosity between him and Dr. McIntyre, because his father-in-law was a returned missionary to China, Dr. Seville. And Dr. Seville came in, and he helped me in getting out that first issue. I had some nice letters from missionaries, and he took from a missionary and made three nice articles and made a heading like Digging in Manchuria, and you know, like that for them. And Dr. Wagner says to me, he says, they'll say they got Dr. Seville in there. Well, I didn't know what it would be hard having Dr. Seville in there. He never liked Dr. Seville for some reason. Right from the start, he was against Dr. Seville. I don't know why.
Didn't Dr. Seville teach then?
Yeah, he taught them. He was a fine influence among the students, a very godly man. But as a teacher, he just was quite poor as a teacher, I'm afraid. And he used to give talks in chapel that were the loveliest talks that had lovely content to them, but nobody listened because it was all so dry and monotonous. And then we had a man teaching public speaking who was the assistant to Dr. Laird, choir director for Dr. Laird, and he gave a course in public speaking, and something funny would happen, and they'd all laugh for 7 or 8 minutes, you know. I mean, he knew a lot about voice, but he graduated from Westminster Choir School, by the way. He knew a lot about voice, but he didn't know how to manage things. So the second year, I suggested to him that I would sit in on the class and administer the class, and we'd get the knowledge from this fellow, which he had, which was very helpful. But we did that, and I said to Dr. Seville, I says, Dr. Seville, I said, would you mind? I'd like you to sit in on this class. So he did. And I gave them, I arranged the course and everything, but let this man use his knowledge, see. And if they wanted to laugh about something, let them laugh for a minute, and I'd stop them. He'd let them go on for 5 minutes, see, if I wasn't there. But I gave them a couple of dramatic poems to practice reading. Now fall on the foe like a tempest of flame, you know, like that. And I called on Dr. Seville, and he did it beautifully. Oh, and you know that fellow? He had a natural talent for expression. Oh, it was good. But when he would speak in chapel, he was just so, you know, that people hardly listened to him. So I said to Dr. Seville, I said, if you would give your chapel talks like this, everybody thinks it's wonderful. And I said, they'd get so much more across. And after that, every time he spoke in chapel, I'd see him for it, and I'd say, no, lots of pep, lots of pep.
Did it help?
He was 30 or 40 years older than I was, but he took it nicely. And you know, the new students the next year, oh, they thought Dr. Seville's chapel talks were wonderful. But the old students, they said, we can't help laughing because it's so different from the way it was last year. Shows what a little organization, can do.
And that's one of the hallmarks of faith in biblical too, has been this emphasis on putting color and expression and dynamism to some.
Yeah.
See,
at first Mr. Curtis taught this course, and it was just, we had a lot of part-time teachers that I didn't know anything about it, but then one day he said to me, he says, I'm teaching at King's College too. And he says, over there, he says, I've got five fellows, and we have 4 hours a week. And here I have a class of 23 fellows, and we have just these 2 hours. Or 1 hour, I guess. I think it's just 1 hour the first year. So I changed that to 2 hours a week. Organized it, you know, and made more time for poetry than we had ever had before. And we that's the one thing we developed with faith. Our speakers were much better speakers than from any other seminar for years. But we developed a system that was... And I wanted everyone, before he graduates, to have had something just right then that would affect them. But faculty wouldn't agree. They're more for, you need so many hours. If you got the credit hours, degree. I wanted the fellows to graduate able to accomplish. And that's what I was my objective. But that, it was work. We worked up a lot of things, you see. And that was one of the grand things. Was the freedom of starting from scratch. You see, at Westminster, we had to have Hebrew 4 to 6 every afternoon. The poorer division was 4 to 5. The better ones was 5 to 6. Four afternoons a week. And one fellow said to me, he says, I don't think the students would hate Hebrew the way they do if it wasn't such a miserable hour, he says. But that was a Princeton tradition. It always been that way at Princeton. Westminster, we couldn't change. Well, we left all the traditions behind us, and we figured what was effective right from the start. We left some. There were some traditions I kind of liked, but that we left behind. But we were free to work things out, practically free. The first year, we were having a... I worked out plans for the year, and there were 2 or 3 things that Dr. McIntyre beat him. He says, no, can't do that. Can't do that. And I was quite disappointed. And I prayed that the Lord would bless this year's work, whether we have another year or not, that he would bless it to the utmost, and he surely did. But he didn't interfere much.
Why did he say he couldn't do things? Did he ever give a reason?
Well, I don't know. He was much influenced by the whole Westminster attitude. I think he would like to have simply carried on like Westminster was. I don't think he had much of the idea of the change and welcome that I had. I don't know. But... there's very little he ever interfered with. We practiced. We ran it the way we thought we ought to run. I made a good many innovations, and we worked out a lot of things by trial and error. The Lord blessed. And we turned out some wonderful fellows. Oh, we turned out some grand fellows.
Where would you like to move from here in the interviewing? Do you want to move through some of those years of faith?
Well, what would you be most interested in?
Well, I think we should deal some with the starting of Covenant Seminary in 56.
Yeah.
But I think we should keep rolling and move on toward the founding of Biblical.
Oh, really? That's what?
As well, not in the next session, but I mean, rather than go chronologically year by year the way we did in the 20s, probably we should start moving through. If you want to pick out some vignettes, as it were, from the 40s, from the early 50s, certain people maybe that trained, also Dr. Buswell's role, faculty changes at Faith, board changes, those developments through the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah,
I think some attention to that would be good. Not in great detail, but certainly focusing on the profile of all those years.
Yes.
And maybe those take a couple of sessions for that.
Those were blessed years.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, as we think about some of the leaders, like you mentioned, Schaefer and others of the early ones, but then you have, again, people like Bill Leonard, Phil Clark, different ones that came along through those years that maybe you would want to comment on as students at the time, or and certainly when we get to our own faculty, when they studied there in the mid-50s, I think we should focus on when you first met them, how they were as students. I think that would, again, be rich background for Biblical just in terms of our current faculty and their time in seminary.
Yeah, the Lord gave me wisdom picking those fellows out. Three, I picked out Harding and Dunsweller and Taylor. Mm. And I don't think any one of them would even be a seminary teacher when the folks left us for Covenant. We had to fill up in a hurry.
Sure. Yeah, we need to get into some of that history.
Sure. Yeah.
Then you don't want to go year by year.
I don't know whether the chronology year by year is quite as meaningful as more maybe focusing on figures, individuals through those years, thinking of some of them. Even Al Oldham, our chairman of our board, of course, was at Faith during those years. Many different people. We might approach it from that standpoint. If you have an old... I know Al Oldham had me get all those Faith alumni a year or two ago. Maybe we could pick out, if I could get that list from him, we could pick out, I'll be seeing him tonight.
Oh, yeah.
We're going down to Harvey Cedars for a couples retreat.
Oh, good.
Maybe I could mention that to him, in fact, and get that alumni list.
He's making a list right now. At least he was.
I think he's developing it further. He had me get some stuff from my brother-in-law at Faith, and now if he can...
A lot of those,
I could give you that. You could think over some of those names, and especially any of them like Phil Clark, Al Oldham, our own faculty, any that had any tie with Biblical later.
Yeah.
It would be good. Or leaders, like people that became leaders in the church.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking is, far down the road, years ahead, is there a sort of systematic chronology anywhere available of those years?
I doubt it.
Because if we don't get it, like, now...
Well, maybe we could try to get the best of both, except I'd like to finish before...
If you had a file of the Beacon, that would remind me.
Sure.
Because most of the things that were at all public would find expression there, and that would give you the chronology.
Yeah.
If you had them.
I'll try to work on that, too.
Yeah.
I just had a call from some student out of Trinity in Chicago about...
Yeah.
Getting a run of the Beacon. Who had one?
Yeah.
I'm not sure who does. Faith has a lot of the earlier years in bound volumes. Westminster has a lot of it, but I'm not sure anybody has a complete run.
Yeah.
And that has some of the historical things in it?
Well, it would have that chronology, just all through it. Again, like Dr. McCrae said, anything would happen. Graduations each year, who was in the classes. Ecclesiastical events.
Because I haven't thought of a lot of this for 40 or 50 years, and it gradually comes back, and I don't remember the chronology till I think about it, think how things interrelated.
Well, Dr. McCrae, would you have the Beacon and things like that stored somewhere?
I got a lot of copies.
Because I could go through them if you would dig them out, and I could put them in a sequence and maybe pull out important things.
Yeah.
It might help us.
Yeah.
If you could put them together, and I'll just go through them.
That might be good.
Yeah.
And what you don't have, we could fill in maybe from Westminster or somewhere. Too bad Dr. McIntyre didn't let Yale microfilm that. I understand they wanted to microfilm it, and he refused. Because then it would be preserved. Because I looked at those volumes down at Faith, and they're deteriorating. It's just newsprint. And my sister, of course, had close contacts and still does with the Beacon office there in Collinswood, and they are poorly organized. They could not. I asked, doing your Feshrit, your bibliography, I asked, which did this come before that? And apparently they are somewhat disorganized. Collinswood building, Reformation building on Haddon Avenue in Collinswood, down the road from McIntyre's Place, where they published it.
Yeah.
And conceive, you know, you think they'd have a complete run, just every issue.
Yeah, they bound them most near every year.
They had some trouble retrieving what I needed. I'm not sure why.
Now, I visited you in the library one time about 10 years ago, and you were just throwing away a bunch of them.
Yeah, they were too deteriorating.
Is that it?
Yeah, with our hot heat in the summer and everything. We really need to get it on microfilm.
Yeah.
That's the way to preserve newsprint.
You were speaking about my resignation and everything. That's all in there, of course. Except my letter of resignation.
Oh, yeah. The earliest years.
The so-called student statement.
Go to Faith and get whatever Dr. McCrae had, two of those early years.
Yeah.
Those would be in there.
There was a student about my second year at Westminster from Canada named Detler, Lyle Detler. And I don't know if he's there 1 year or 2 years, but anyway, went back to Canada. And then the last year I was there, he was in school. And I never saw him to talk to us. But when I resigned, he wrote me a letter. And he said what a difference between the whole spirit of the institution when he was there before and now, and all he wrote. I mean, it fully substantiates the attitude I took. And I gave Dr. McIntyre a copy and said he ought to print the Beacon. Oh, I don't want to print that. He says they'll say we're just tearing down and destructive. So you don't do that. But then they went after him pretty hot the next two or three weeks, and then he published it. So that year's Beacon would contain his letter and my letter, and of course the student statement, so-called, which Dr. Kuiper's son-in-law wrote, that's in the Ryan's book, The Present Truth. To include that statement, not include mine, is, I thought, pretty funny. But that's in there. And of course, when one's facts, they need those statements.
Yeah. Well, thank you very
much. Well, there's so much happened through the years, and things you haven't thought of for
40
years.
Well, that's why this oral history is so valuable. Although, I wouldn't worry too much about... I guess what I'm trying to say is there's also interest in what does occur to you. In other words, if you get something slightly out of chronologically or something, there's that aspect of, well, here's someone reflecting 50 years later.
Yeah.
Well, what does strike them?
Yeah.
What does come to mind first? There's a certain dimension of human and historical interest in that, too. Versus just picking up a book and reading a run of The Beacon. You know?
Yeah.
So to have you doing it now and kind of just evoking, there's an element in that that has interest, too.
Remember, I mentioned how Woodbridge, this secretary, you know, she was 100% with us, 100% loyal. But one day, Woodbridge, of course, had resigned. But one day, he comes in the office. I was out. And she just was absolutely submissive to him. It was his personality. Oh. And then after we left, they made him secretary of their new board they were going to form, was it? Anyway, he wrote, I guess their home mission board, and he wrote articles in their paper, the Presbyterian Guardian, telling about how their students were on the street corners presenting the gospel and so on, just as unlike Westminster graduates as you could think, you know, but gave such a picture that would just appeal to the fundamentalists everywhere. He went on that way for a month, and then he suddenly disappeared and turned up as pastor of a Southern Presbyterian church. And before that, he'd been saying, the Southern church is just as bad as the Northern, not quite as far along. Because he'd been always talking that way. But Ed Ryan said the two saddest days in his life were the day Dr. Machen died and the day that Charlie Woodbridge left the movement and went to the South. And I asked, later he became dean of students at Fuller Seminary. And that last year at Faith, I asked him, I said, how many of the people in your church in Salisbury, North Carolina, do you think are still standing for this word? He says, probably none. And I said, how in your other church there? Well, probably none. But he went down there and told how all his ancestors had been Southern Presbyterians and everything. And of course, they were against the whole breakoff movement up here very strongly, but he made a tremendous impression on the presbytery, telling about his ancestors, you know. And he had these two big churches, and then he went to Fuller. And now he's the most extreme separationist in the country. He's got a son who is teaching. John Woodbridge is teaching and writing books in Trinity. And Dr. Dunbar says if John writes a letter to his father, he gets back a long letter to tell him how wicked it is for him to be at Trinity Seminary, where they're called compromisers and so on. Very strong. He's just got to be extreme. But oh, what a personality he had. Tremendous. Right. He and McIntyre are the two I just wow people just by their personality. And McIntyre can sure do it when he wants to. I would talk with a member of our board for 40 minutes and present something to him. Oh, he thought it was great. He's going to stand for it in the board. I'd pinch him in the board like your language. That's impossible. Couldn't do it. Immediately, this man speaks against it. He told me he was for it. I decide there's no use talking to the board member. Talk to McIntyre. If he says yes, go ahead. If he doesn't, why give the idea up?
Weird.
But the two of them, they just have a marvelous gift of personality. And if they only can follow a straight line, and McIntyre's done that a lot more than Woodbridge has, because he's gone this way and that, in his life to some extent, but they can only follow a straight line and not get too sure of themselves, they can accomplish more than ordinary people.
It's too bad that they're both kind of shipwrecked.
Yeah, it's a shame.
They could be being used so wonderfully. That was more.
Yeah. I mentioned there was a man who'd been in the United States Department of Labor, I guess, for his life, and he was retired. And he belonged to a little Bible Christian church, and I ran onto him. And I said, it's a shame the way Dr. McIntyre's done so many good things, started so much that's wonderful, and then was just wrecked so much. Yes, he says, it's like a cow that gives a gallon of good milk and then kicks over the bucket. I thought that was a marvelous illustration.
That is. That is. You think of faith and self. And then he never seems to realize that he's done that.
Never
does. He just goes on naively as if he's living in shambles, but it could be a palace.
Yeah.
It's like even at my niece's wedding a year ago, July.
Yeah.
He would have had us thinking as we were standing back there, Gordon and his brother and I and the other the groomsmen, as though the sanctuary were full.
Oh.
I mean, just, wow, they're filling the sanctuary out there. Of course, we knew it wasn't true.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a nice crowd for the wedding, but it's just kind of a delusion. As far as he was concerned, it was like it used to be.
Weird.
But he didn't interact very much personally, as far as a close personal. He's just most of the time just kind of looking down his nose through the crack between the door to, you know.
But he
didn't really interact with the groomsmen and so on.
He can if he wants to.
Yeah, probably.
Oh,
although, of course, now he's way up in years, too. There's probably that factor. I think years ago that would have come out more.
Yeah,
he's really quite elderly now, but he doesn't seem to recognize that either.
Well, it's amazing his energies always have. Even now, I guess.
Well, it's what keeps him going, I guess. He'd probably die if he wasn't charging.
I sat down in 19 when I went to Pakistan. When was that? About 68. Yeah, 68. I said, Carl, I wish you'd make a list of all the things you're mixed up in. And then go through the list and cross out half of them. And I said, I think you could do the other half in a way that would last after your death. Oh, he says, I got another 20 years. That is nearly 20 years. But he's got less now than he had then. But he leaves so many loose ends because he does so many things.
We had a couple students from Faith. One is from Brazil, knows Dr. Garros.
Oh, really?
And so on. She's made transfer from Faith up here. And one is from Nigeria or somewhere.
Oh, really?
They were just up here last week visiting as prospective students.
Okay.
But they were over at my sister's and brother-in-law's for Thanksgiving a year ago.
Oh.
And I met her, and she knows Dr. Garros and a number of people that they knew in common.
Yeah.
Of course, my sister had gone to college with his son. And
with the?
Poe Garros.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well,
they went to Shelton together back in the 50s. It wasn't the same year exactly, but they overlapped.
And she was a girl from Brazil?
This girl is now studying at Faith. She's from Brazil. She's from, I think, from that church.
Really?
But I'm not sure
from the Conservative Church.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.